Talks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Life Science Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to keep you up to date. This week on the show, we are discussing a study looking at the effects of ADHD drugs in preschoolers and epigenetic editing with CRISPR. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. I'm Sarah Hand, editor-in-chief at xtalks.com, and this week I'm joined by Aisha Rashid, Sydney Perlmutter, and Mira Nabulsi. Thanks for coming today. Aisha, I think you have something to start us off with, so take it away.
Sure. Thank you, Sarah. So May is Mental Health Awareness Month, during which time, of course, the focus is on spreading awareness on mental and behavioral health issues to help people living with various mental health conditions and to also help reduce the stigma around many of them. And so in light of this, I came across a study dealing with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. So this is a new study that came out of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And the study was a retrospective study that looked at the effectiveness and side effects of stimulants like Ritalin and compared that to the side effects and effectiveness of alpha-adrenergic agonists like guanfacine or 10X in preschool-age children with ADHD. So this is the first large-scale study of its kind to compare ADHD drugs in preschoolers. And so ADHD actually is one of the most common mental health disorders affecting children in the U.S., and it's estimated that about 8 to 9% of kids have ADHD compared to about 2.5% of adults, and approximately 2.4% of preschool-age children are diagnosed with ADHD. And according to the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, older children with ADHD are at an increased risk for mental, behavioral, and emotional disorders, such as mood and behavioral disorders, substance abuse, and even suicide. So if left undiagnosed and unaddressed, untreated, these risks can lead to injury, disease, and even death. So it's very important to have prompt diagnosis and prompt treatment for ADHD. So this study was very interesting because, again, as I mentioned, looking at ADHD drugs in children as young as, you know, 3-4 years old, basically under the age of 6, preschoolers, hasn't been done before. So the conventional treatment for ADHD in preschoolers, the first-line treatment is behavioral therapy. So that includes all – that also actually includes training for parents. And then medications are there as well. And so for kids younger than 6, the CDC recommends behavioral therapy to be that first line of treatment before any drugs are administered, because young children experience more side effects from ADHD drugs than older kids do. And so among drugs for ADHD in preschoolers, stimulants are recommended as first line medication. However, a quarter of kids, preschoolers, are treated with alpha-adrenergic agonist medications, despite minimal evidence for their efficacy or adverse effects in this age range. And so for this reason, the authors of this study wanted to compare and take a look at the effects of stimulants versus the alpha-adrenergic agonists. So in the study, they took a look at the electronic health records of about 497 kids seen at seven different developmental behavioral pediatric practices between 2013 and 2017 to assess the use, effectiveness, and side effects of stimulants versus the alpha-adrenergic agonists in preschoolers. And so the researchers found that While both groups experienced improvements in symptoms, whether it was whether they were taking a stimulant or whether they took the alpha adrenergic agonist. And there was actually a slightly larger benefit among those prescribed stimulants. So it's 78% versus 66%. Now, in terms of side effects, kids, preschoolers that took the alpha adrenergic agonists had fewer side effects than those taking stimulants. So these kids had lower rates of things like moodiness, irritability, appetite suppression, and difficulty sleeping. And so the authors say that this is really the first study of this size to report on the frequency of improvement in side effects of drugs like guanfacine, the alpha adrenergic agonist, in preschool children. And I think this was really important to do because, as I mentioned, first-line therapy is for ADHD in kids this age are stimulants. And however, we all know that over time and in older children, over-medicating with an abuse of stimulants like Ritalin has been a growing problem. And so, this study is very, very interesting. I think it was very, very important as well. And really to see how many kids are affected by ADHD, we know that it is a growing problem, especially in developed countries. Also, I personally wasn't aware that this is also a growing problem amongst preschoolers. Mm. And so it's really important and, again, interesting, like I said, that they did this study and specifically to evaluate the safety, efficacy, and the side effects of drugs like alpha adrenergic agonists, which hadn't been looked at in preschoolers before. So this could be a better alternative to stimulants. Also, I came across the fact that almost like 80 to 85% of ADHD cases are undiagnosed. So, you know, 85% of people who have ADHD are not even diagnosed in the first place. So, having sort of heard about all of this, what are your thoughts about how better we could potentially screen for ADHD earlier, especially in kids? So that they can get treatment. Do you think the onus is more so on parents to look out for symptoms, teachers, of course, your family doctor? I think it's a team effort, essentially. And how do you think we're faring with that?
Well, I think similar to you, Aisha, I didn't really know that ADHD affected preschoolers so much. When I think of that, I think of, older kids or maybe into tweens and teens type age. In your research, did you come across how it's diagnosed right now in younger populations, so in preschool age kids? Because I'm wondering if part of the difficulty here is in identifying, okay, which kids are actually having this problem, may be hyperactive, and which kids are just like regular 4 and 5 year olds, right? Because there's a lot of they're active at that age, and don't always have the best attention spans. And you know, some kids as they enter kindergarten and that sort of thing have are better at sitting quietly on the mat than mm-hmm. others, and that's a natural thing. Did you come across anything about how this is diagnosed?
Yeah, so I mean, the signs and symptoms of ADHD in preschoolers and toddlers, essentially, it's the three main things of inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. Mm-hmm. So these are basically, I think, the same signs in older kids as well. Hmm. So yeah, it's nothing too specific, or it doesn't differ so much from the diagnosis criteria in older kids.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting.
I also didn't really think to categorize ADHD as a mental health disorder as well. So it's great that you're bringing this up, especially since it is affecting a lot of children. But I'm really shocked that so many cases go undiagnosed. I know we're sort of in an age where parents are really like looking out for their children and want the best for them medically. But I think often, like you were saying, Sarah, it kind of gets off as, oh, maybe my child is just, you know, they get distracted a little bit more easily. So mm-hmm. yeah, I agree. The onus sort sort of falls on everyone and not necessarily the child, because at that age, you can't really advocate for yourself. So I think just being more aware of specific signs and symptoms rather than just general being a child and being maybe more easily distracted is definitely going to be required just to get a better handle on the actual, you know, amount of children with ADHD.
Yeah, and to add to that is like not mistaking, you know, hyperactivity and impulsivity with misbehavior or bad behavior or bad, you know, having a bad kid, because that also affects the mental health of a kid in the long run, I think. And especially because we're talking about Mental Health Week and ADHD being so, you know, and not diagnosed in kids and growing up with such diseases. I think, yeah, definitely this comes down to a lot of awareness and knowledge before, you know, trying to implement different ways to tackle this, I think.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where there's both a stigma attached to kind of putting a label on that, and potentially, you know, having to make the decision to medicate your child, which I think is not an easy one, particularly in these young ages. And on the flip side, I think there's also this idea of you hear so much now about ADHD around a lot of different ages, you know, not only kids, but adults that are 30 and they're just being diagnosed now and they go, oh, well, that's why I had so many problems in school and that sort of thing. So there's kind of two sides of it. And I think that makes it tricky as well. And I'm sure makes it tricky to diagnose in these younger kids as well. And I think, as you've all said, the onus really lies on, you know, the parents and other caregivers and teachers and people who are around the child a lot, to be able to identify, you know, if there's a problem and take it from there, I guess. But yeah, this is an interesting study.
Absolutely. And
yeah, I was going to add about that whole idea of stigma. I feel like a lot of people use ADHD as a term in conversation. So like, you know, someone be like, yeah, ignore me, I just have ADHD. And that kind of makes it kind of like the whole, oh, I have OCD, but you don't actually have OCD.
Making light of it kind of
a thing. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that kind of skews a parent's idea of ADHD and how to treat a child that possibly does actually have ADHD, you know. I don't know. I feel like this word is being thrown around a lot in our society nowadays, that it's kind of desensitizing those that do have ADHD also.
Yeah, you're right, because, you know, you hear parents even saying, oh, my kid is just hyperactive, you know, not realizing it could actually be a clinical sort of disorder here, you know, that could manifest. And, you know, the repercussions of it into adulthood, like, could be very grave. So I think it's really important that parents also, take it seriously and take their kids to the doctors. And I feel like just in general, you know, for that side, when you visit your family physician for an annual checkup, I feel that perhaps they could incorporate mental health screening. I'm not sure if they do for kids or not, but I don't think they do for adults. But I feel that that should be taken into consideration, because not a lot of people as adults, because of the stigma around mental health disorders and issues, many are not comfortable sharing their experience or what they're going through. And maybe if a clinician or a healthcare provider had the tools to screen, ask the questions, and maybe they could identify these sorts of issues earlier. Mm-hmm. I know that when I visit my family doctor, there's no such thing. And I remember my mother was going through some mental health issues a couple of years ago when her brother passed away. And, you know, we had to force her to go and speak to her family doctor. And, you know, her family doctor was just making light of it. Oh, it's fine, it's fine. But then, you know, when she started talking to her, then she realized how, you know, grave the issue could be. But I just feel like it should be a part of general screening, in my opinion.
I definitely agree, especially in the age of children going to school from home and not having a lot of, you know, people around them, I think now more than ever is so important for children's mental health. And I totally agree. It should definitely be, you know, on the same level as physical health when they go to, go to the doctor.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, during this pandemic, right, we keep hearing the effects on mental health, but we won't really know until we're out of it. And, you know, these types of effects are usually long lasting. And so it's going to be really important to be cognizant and aware of the issues and for healthcare providers to sort of be there to help patients.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing you brought up there, Sydney, about mental health and kids in general right now during the pandemic. I read recently that the Canadian Pediatric Society wrote an open letter to the Ontario government saying they need to immediately reopen outdoor spaces because they're seeing that the impact that this, you know, these repeated lockdowns over the past, 14, 16 months have just been so detrimental to mental health of everyone, but in particular, you know, kids and adolescents. And that's a tough thing right now. I understand the governments are just trying to keep people safe, but I think it's going to be the mental health ramifications that are going to be longer lasting. Even once the pandemic's under control again, right? There's going to be a lot to rebuild here, particularly in kids.
Definitely a great conversation there around mental health. And as I mentioned, you know, the whole month of May is Mental Health Awareness Month. So definitely great to read more about research in mental health and stories on the topic. So moving to another story that I wrote about last week. Now, this is a very interesting new tool that I came across. So researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, and the Whitehead Institute have developed a new CRISPR-based tool called CRISPR-Off that can switch off genes in human cells through epigenetic editing without altering the genetic sequence itself. And so traditionally, CRISPR, of course, it has totally revolutionized molecular biology with its power of being able to edit the genome, and it's called the molecular scissors. So you can go in and, you know, make precise edits to genetic sequences. However, this tool does not alter the genetic sequence itself, but it actually regulates gene expression by inducing modifications on specific regions within genes. And so this is being seen as a more safer way to alter gene expression because you're not toying with the sequence itself. You're not making cuts into genetic sequences and doesn't involve any kind of editing per se. And that would not cause any potential harmful off-target genomic changes. So this new tool called CRISPR-Off is being dubbed a programmable epigenetic memory writer, and it can initiate heritable gene silencing. And once a gene is switched off, it actually can remain silenced or off in the cell's daughter cells or progeny for hundreds of generations. And conversely, this genes can actually also be switched on with a complementary tool called CRISPR-On, and that's also been described in this paper that was published earlier this month in the journal Cell. So the CRISPR gene editing system consists of the Cas9 enzyme, which serves as the molecular scissors, which actually cleaves double-stranded DNA, a guide RNA template that targets to a specific genomic sequence, and that allows for the precise editing. However, for the CRISPR-Off system, the researchers generated a dead Cas9 enzyme fusion protein that, instead of inducing cuts in double-stranded DNA, what it does is that it mediates DNA methylation and repressive histone modifications. And DNA methylation is an important epigenetic feature or modification where basically a methyl group is added to DNA bases, specifically cytosines next to guanine residues in what are called CpG islands. So basically, these are genomic regions that are rich in cytosine and guanine residues. And so DNA methylation occurs endogenously in mammalian cells in response to various stimuli. It's a very powerful way of silencing genes. And there are also, there's a lot of research into epigenetic therapy, such as DNA methyltransferase inhibitors like azacitidine, which are used as hypomethylating agents in the treatment of diseases like myelodysplastic syndrome and sometimes in AML as well. So the researchers actually tweaked there were original prototypes of this tool. Several, you know, groups in Italy and Japan have been working on this, and the UCSF researchers actually modified the original prototype. So this new prototype actually includes three different domains of three different proteins, including two DNMT, the DNA methyltransferase family members, which essentially are responsible for methylation, and fused to the catalytically or the dead Cas9 enzyme. Now, so traditionally or typically, the dogma is that methylation occurs in these CpG island or CGI regions. So basically, these regions rich in cytosine guanine residues, and of course, methylation occurs on the cytosine residues. However, so that's kind of limiting, actually, or the researchers thought it was limiting at first, because only about 30%, there are 30% of genes in the genome don't have these CGIs. So the idea was that these genes would not be included in the repertoire of genes that could be silenced. So that was kind of limiting. However, the surprising finding here was that through doing genome-wide CRISPR off-screens, the researchers found that the large majority of genes could actually be silenced, even those that lacked these canonical annotated CGIs. So that really opens up like a much wider targeting window where you can target so many or the vast majority of genes, whether or not they contain these CGI islands than previously thought. And the other interesting finding was that these modifications, so this, so methylation of these areas in genes could actually be inherited. So they found that a cell could divide for as many as 450 generations, and those methylation marks were still there. And they actually even found that they could be maintained as cells transition from stem cells to mature neurons, is what they looked at. This was very exciting because really there were a lot of safety concerns with the conventional CRISPR tool. You could have off-target effects with altering the DNA sequences themselves. So with this CRISPR off, it's very promising. And of course, further work is needed to realize its full therapeutic potential. So I just wanted to know your thoughts about this. Also, although this is not a tool that will alter the DNA sequence, you're still altering the expression of genes, right? So you're turning off gene expression, you can turn it on. Do you think any ethical concerns surround this as well? We know that CRISPR has a lot of power and a lot of ethical concerns surround the technology. Although this is a safer way to regulate gene expression, I feel that it still comes with some ethical concerns, especially when you talk about modulating gene expression.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. Is this only applicable to people who have a heterozygous disease? So if you're turning off the, you know, faulty copy of a gene and then relying on the normal complement, is that the only place where this is useful, do you think? Or could it also be useful for treating like recessive diseases for which you have two faulty copies? You know what I mean? I guess it would depend on the disease probably, right? But most of the time you've got a gene that has a function, it's not functioning properly, and then disease ensues. So you'd think you'd want to like switch one gene for the other, basically. But I'm not sure if that's the case here.
Yeah, I would. I think it would depend on the disease, but I don't see why there's no reason, like you were saying, in a recessive situation where you could potentially turn off both copies of the faulty genes. Also, it's a bit limiting, I think, because this is only used to turn off genes, right? So in cases where you have silenced genes leading to disease.
Right.
I mean, they have this CRISPR-on tool, but I'm not sure if they can actually use it in endogenous cases.
Maybe that can only be used to turn back on what you've turned off
already? You've turned off, exactly.
Okay.
So that perhaps in that way, I'm thinking the tool could be limited. But yeah, they haven't, I think this is very preliminary, so they haven't really you know, made any suggestions in terms of what types of diseases they could target and such.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it, like you said, it has less, there's less opportunity for off-target effects that are the problem with CRISPR. Like, I think, you know, we've been hearing a ton about CRISPR for the last 5-6 years. And at first everyone was like, whoa, this is going to, you know, change everything. I think there's still that problem with the off-target effects that, that needs to be solved. I think that's still likely a problem here, although maybe not as much. I could see you still designing like the sequence that it needs to bind to and having that bind to other similar sequences throughout the genome and potentially turning those off as well. But yeah. As you say, it's preliminary, right now.
Yeah, and the other thing, I think it was interesting. I was actually sitting in on a webinar a couple of months ago, and they were discussing like gene therapies and things like this. And one of the speakers mentioned that there is sort of like a sensationalism or like a very exclusive sensationalism associated with anything genetic, right? You know, it takes you back to like, you know, sci-fi things and like generation of these mutants and things like that, right? You know, sci-fi characters. And so that kind of excites people and also scares people at the same time, right? So do you guys think, you know, when, in your opinion, when you hear something like a genetic technology, does that sort of cross your mind? Like what kind of sensationalist type of ideas, if any, cross your mind? Or do you think we're steering away from that kind of sci-fi kind of stuff? Or is that still there? I mean, we could talk about even the vaccines, right? The adenoviral vector-based COVID-19 vaccines. As soon as people heard, oh, wow, these are DNA-based vaccines, it was just a lot of people were uncomfortable with that idea. Oh, can it alter my DNA and things like that? So there, you know, there's still that hesitancy and that sensationalism associated with anything genetic related.
Yeah, go ahead, Sydney.
I think of kind of not necessarily the physical attributes, like changing eye colors and making someone taller. But I like to have a more positive and productive outlook on these things, because that's genuinely what I think is being accomplished. And I think controlling certain genetic illnesses is really a big one for me. And since I have a genetic illness in my family that I don't want to pass on, so I can only really be hopeful about this technology. And it sounds great to me, though confusing.
I'm sorry,
since I do not have a science background, but
no, it's okay. Less jargony.
There's only so many layman's terms you can put things into. But yeah, I have a really positive outlook, and I try to ignore the sensationalist aspects of it, although I'm keenly aware that there are ethical issues with it as well.
I think that's like really honest of you to say, Sydney, and I think that's For one person, whereas you're very positive about it, for another person who, you know, also doesn't fully understand all the intricacies of this, their response might be fear, right? And so I think it comes down to something we've talked about a lot on this podcast, in that we just need to get better communicating
it was science communication, I think, in general. And I think that's something we've seen throughout the pandemic. But with stuff like this, especially, it seems immediately scary, like you were saying, Aisha, the idea of changing the genome somehow. And I, you know, there are certainly ethical concerns. I think when people bring those up as a reason then, you know, not to do this kind of stuff, I get really sad, because I think that can't be the reason why we don't make breakthroughs in treating diseases, you know, because we're concerned about that. Certainly we can have those concerns. I just don't think that that should slow the process of innovation in these areas. And certainly there's got to be conversations about how do we regulate this? You know, how do we make sure it doesn't fall into the wrong hands? How do we make sure it's not abused? I don't see the science fiction dystopian future as much as some people tout when they read about this kind of stuff. I'm also pretty positive, like you, Sydney. I think this is mostly going to be used for good. And certainly there's definitely more research that needs to be done. No one's talking about like, oh, we've come up with this new CRISPR off technology. Let's just like go ahead and throw that into someone and like see what happens. There's so much more that needs to go into it and go into the research there. So I'm confident in the future of this.
I totally agree with you too, but I can't stop to think about the evil in the world, and that's where the idea of this will be used badly would come from, right? Is like, we all want this innovation to stop hereditary diseases and all that kind of stuff, but at the end of the day, we think about those evil people or the bad guys in, you know, in reality that are, you know, going to use this unethically or incorrectly and create monetization purposes to, you know, designer babies or whatever it is. I think that was the big keyword that was thrown around when CRISPR first started revolutionizing the world is the idea of designer babies and designer children. I think definitely this is all very revolutionary stuff, and hopefully it is used for the better. And I wish I could see it the way you guys see it, but I do see it as an industry making money using this technology in the all sorts of ways that it can. That's my opinion on it, to be honest. So I do see the whole idea of, you know, being alien to a lot of people and them not fully understanding what this is. And, you know, kind of like the reaction we got with mRNA vaccinations with COVID, just like Aisha was saying, I think the same applies here, just in a longer term.
Yeah, and you know, we're not even there with stuff like, you know, with gene therapies. I remember for, you know, I think it's probably been like close to 20 years now that we've been hearing that gene therapy is the answer. But we still haven't been able to completely, safely, and effectively deliver gene therapies for many diseases. Yeah. Many trials have taken, you know, of course, are taking place. But it hasn't been that breakthrough that we thought it would initially be. So a lot of these technologies, yes, proof of concept wise, in the lab or in vivo in animal studies, they seem great, but really translating and bringing that to patients and to the clinic to treat actual diseases is a whole other ball game. And I think, you know, with scientists and clinicians, people should have great trust in that. Like, people are not just going to throw around these kinds of things untested. Whenever I hear about new gene-based therapies or genetic-based therapies, this new tool is really great, and it's a great sort of offshoot of CRISPR in terms of being safer. But I can't just help but think, going back to, you know, sort of always the buzz around gene therapies, and we're not quite there yet. So I think it's, I'm not skeptical, but I think it's going to take a lot more time than we think it is until we see this play out in terms of actual treatments.
Right. And that's a good point, Aisha. I think the other consideration here is that these are really moving into that truly bespoke therapy territory. And that's really where pharma and biopharma has been headed. We hear a lot more about precision medicine and personalized medicine. But that comes at a huge cost, not obviously just the R&D cost to get it there. But then once things like this are approved, they're very expensive. And so I think down the line, if this shows it's something that we could be putting into practice to treat these diseases, that's great. But there's going to be a whole rethink around, you know, who's going to pay for this? How are we going to pay for this? The companies that will be that have developed these therapies need to kind of recoup their costs in some way. So I'm sure they're going to have a pretty high price tag. Who can afford that? Who can't? There's so many more considerations down the line as well in terms of affordability and how these will be given out. Yeah. Okay, well, that is the end of this episode of the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. If you like today's show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thanks, everyone, and see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X-Talks on social media, email podcast@xtalks.com, or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.